Well, good afternoon, everybody, and thank you for joining our webinar today, Educational Publishing at Work. The revolutionary technologies of a century ago, mass-produced pencils and faster printing presses, have given way to new technology, computers, Wii, Xbox 360, smart boards, iPods, iPads, cell phones, and more. And educators are experiencing the information age and need to keep both materials as well as the context that those materials are delivered in relevant for students. This shift is affecting both publishers and printers. And if you're serious about collaboratively addressing the challenges facing educators today and continuing to play a central role in supporting teachers, introducing new technologies, and bringing practical innovation into the classrooms is absolutely essential. Before we get started today, what I would like to do is make sure that we give you a few housekeeping tips, and then I'll introduce the speakers that will talk to you about how to make educational publishing work today. First of all, if you need help in terms of getting online, or if you need help, press the online help button, and you'll see how to get help with the system. If you're viewing slides, today's slide presentation should automatically advance in sync with the audio presentation. If the slides don't change, you can press the F5 button. You can also download a PDF or open and save a copy of the slides in PDF. You can press enlarge slides to get a larger view of the slides. If you like what you're seeing or hearing, you can use the invite a colleague button, or you can let us know by clicking the survey button and sending your feedback. You can submit questions today by using the Ask a Question box, and you can view this event on demand for the next 90 days. Now, to get started, what I would like to do is introduce our speakers. I'm going to open it and just spend a couple of minutes talking to you about what's going on in the educational market. Then what you'll hear from is Charlene Gaynor, and Charlene is the CEO of the Educational Association for Publishers. You'll then hear from Senior Vice President of Britannica Encyclopedia, Michael Ross, and Michael will share with you what's going on at Encyclopedia Britannica. And then you'll hear from VP of Operations from the Mercury Printing Book Division, Christian Schomburger. And so without further ado, let's get started. When you think about the educational publishing market, what I tell everybody is it's still all about teaching and learning. And there's a scope and a sequence to education. And there's content and there's context. The key elements that we're dealing with today are that all of the tools are changing. And while print isn't dead, it's no longer the unrivaled leader in the educational resource market. What we're finding from new reports out of the Educational Market Research group is that 54% of the companies that they polled last year were using online and digital means to deliver supplemental education products. That's a 41.2% increase over the previous year and almost five times the reported level in 2006. There are things like netbooks and mobile devices that are growing in terms of utilization at 200% per year. You're seeing learning management systems being implemented to augment interactions with the teacher and the students. The message is we've come a long way. We're also seeing students that are referred to in a lot of instances as digital natives. And basically what you're finding is that these digital natives grew up in an era of digital technology. They don't know a world without video games, the internet, and mobile technology. And so they're processing information differently than their predecessors. And what we find is that publishers and educators need to adapt to the environment of these digital natives. But they also need to make sure that they retain to some extent, an accent or a foot in the past. And so what we're going to be doing today is really exploring what's going on with technology. We're going to be looking at new business models. We'll be exploring new delivery systems. We'll be talking about where publishers and printers fit in the conversion continuum from print to digital. And we're going to learn how printers and publishers are moving along this continuum. And so with that as a background, what I'd like to do is turn it over to Charlene Gaynor. And Charlene, again, is the CEO of the Association of Educational Publishers. And so with that, Shelley, I'm going to let you take it away. A reminder to everybody, please submit your questions throughout the webinar, and we'll get to them as you submit them. So, Charlene, take it away.
All right. Thank you, Barb, and thank you for inviting me to participate in this webinar. Certainly, this transformation from print to digital is at the heart of what we at AEP are thinking about and talking about and helping our members with. I wanted to tell you a little bit about AEP, the Association of Educational Publishers, and a little bit about our industry for those of you who are not actively engaged in the educational publishing arena. AEP has been around for about 115 years. We're a 501c3 nonprofit, and we're focused exclusively on educational publishing. We have about 400 members and affiliate members who produce learning resources in all kinds of media. One of the most interesting things about our K-12 market, which is whom we publish for primarily, is that, you know, there are a variety of customers. We have states, districts, schools, individual teachers, and even individual parents, and everyone, I think, is focused on providing educational solutions that will address 21st century skills and learners. So to give you a little bit of a context in which to place the market, there are about 14,000 school districts. There are about 133,000 K-12 schools, 3.2 million teachers, and, of course, 35-plus million households with children. So all of these represent a segment of our marketplace and a segment of the constituents that educational publishers are aiming at. A thing that I think people might not realize is that, you know, when you think of school materials, you think of textbooks, which represents a little over $2 billion. But there's another $3 billion in what is called the supplemental materials, and that can represent a wide, wide range of materials in all media, certainly including instructional and library materials that are print, online. There's video, mixed media, assessments, which is a big area, producing materials to assess learning, periodicals, trade books packaged in classroom sets, other kinds of reference materials and teacher resources, and, of course, educational games, which is really kind of a hot area. Puzzles, toys, maps, globes, those things are called manipulatives. It's a very wide and diverse market that educational publishers are publishing for. And, you know, so for them, there are certainly very critical trends right now, as with publishing as a whole. And the first one of those, you know, is sort of the e-everything phenomenon, this notion that everyone is scrambling to figure out their place in the print-to-digital transformation. And as you'll see as we go along, you know, it isn't necessarily really an absolute transformation. And, in fact, our definition of, you know, digital, the digital world for our publishers is the capacity to deliver content 24/7 in any medium, you know, any media, any way, any time. A big issue is the F word, free. Everyone is really struggling to figure out how they can compete in an arena in which everything is free online. But we're beginning to get a little smarter about that, and there are lots of companies within our industry who really learned how to leverage free as a tremendous marketing tool and a way of, you know, replacing traditional sampling programs and building audiences on the Internet and driving them to their own sites where they sell. We have one publisher who learned very early that when she has a book that she suspects could be a bestseller, she puts it online for free. And that immediately increases sales by about 30%. So, I mean, another issue, I call it, what are we, chopped liver? I mean, this is really the whole notion of, well, what's the value of publishing? If everyone can go online and get everything they want, what is it that we're bringing to the table? And I think that's a very central issue for all of us to understand and grapple with, and something that we're going to have to be focusing on for quite a while. mean, AEP is actually sort of rebranded our own conference, which we have every year in June, and to we call it Content in Context. And it's actually a little plug here, June 6th through the 8th in Washington. And we concentrate exactly on helping publishers address these issues, including, you know, what's the value that you need to bring to the table. A couple other things that are specific to the education market are sort of dicey demographics. You know, teachers are aging. The demographics of students and ethnicity are changing. We have what I call kamikaze politics. You know, whatever happens every 4 years can significantly change what educational publishers have to focus on. Certainly the Common Core Standards, which I hope is a phrase that most of you are familiar with, is something that publishers really have to pay attention to, since the materials that they produce, you know, have to reflect what schools need to teach. And then the ESEA, which is the Elementary and Secondary Education Act. This is reauthorized every 7 years. It is up for reauthorization, and that is the legislation that produced the No Child Left Behind initiative, and it is about to be reviewed, and there are some questions about what will come out of that. Certainly innovation is a big focus of this administration, so there's expected to be some emphasis on that. For teachers in general, though, I mean, accountability is king, so we need to be very mindful of how we make our own materials accountable, as well as how we help teachers be accountable. And finally, you know, if the economy is stupid, everyone knows that the economy is having a tremendous impact on education, particularly at the state level, where the majority of funding for education comes from.
Shelley, you mentioned, and as long as we're on this point, you mentioned on this slide dicey demographics. And I've got a question from one of our webinar participants, and the question is, how might we best bridge the gap between those digital native kids and how the immigrant adults teach? How do you make the kid piece high-tech enough and yet easy enough for the immigrants to understand?
Well, that's a good question, and I mean, I'm not trying to be flip, but the answer, you know, the answer is potentially something as simple as, you know, the kids will just outlast them. I mean, the demographics show that, honestly, the majority of the teaching population will reach retirement over the next 5 years, 5 to 10 years, and they will be replaced by other digital natives. And pretty soon there will be a generation of teachers who only grew up with technology as well. In the interim, training, and professional development for teachers is a really essential piece.
Great. Thanks, Charlene.
I'm showing you a couple of pieces of data here that confirm what we all suspect, that there really is a shift from, you know, print to other types of media. We have certainly seen it here. I was mentioning earlier offline that we do an awards program of educational materials, and, you know, the shift in what we receive in print to what we've received in digital form has happened almost overnight, complete flip. But in a more, you know, specific way, we've got some research from education market research that shows reported by publishers what they're doing in terms of delivering on different platforms. IWB is interactive whiteboard, and HD is handheld devices. And you can see that the print and web, I think, are at 60 and 54% respectively, are almost neck and neck. And what's most significant about that is the significant increase growth in web delivery over the period of just a year. Another measure for you, again, this is also from the same education market research study, is what publishers have reported in terms of where they've lost money in sales and where they've gained money in sales by product. and by medium. And you can see clearly interactive whiteboards is where the growth is. Traditional print teacher materials is where the sales are diminishing. So all of this more or less points to the fact that this kind of transformation and shift is happening, and I would say over the course of the last 18 months in an increasingly accelerated pace. And again, this is information from an outside source, Future Source Consulting, about interactive whiteboards and their anticipated expected penetration into U.S. classrooms. It's been increasing significantly, and by 2013, it's anticipated that more than half of U.S. classrooms will have interactive whiteboards, which obviously is also driving publishers to produce for that platform. Again, I'll tell you personally, looking at the entries that we have had this year, there were lots of entries for the interactive whiteboard. But as a medium, I think that's something that publishers are still working on to perfect, how to really use that medium to its fullest extent. It's a learning curve for publishers, teachers. The only ones who seem to be the quick studies are the students. All right, so what does all of this mean? I have a small group of folks I call my scoop group, and whenever I want to get a read on things, I send out an email and ask them to take their pulse. And so I'm calling these points hunches. They're not really substantiated by fact, but they're hunches from pretty well-respected and reliable sources. And so what we think, based on their input, is going to be happening is that the economic crisis will accelerate the rate of change, and it may be that educational publishing sort of moves the dial for other sectors of publishing as well. Schools just can't afford to pay for textbooks, and so they're going to need to find other ways to provide instructional materials, and that is likely to change the way materials have been acquired by schools traditionally and accelerate the rate of change. Our folks believe that actually this free thing will eventually prove to be an asset because it will make it easier to see what you get when you get something that has been vetted and researched and placed properly into a scope and sequence versus something that you can take off the internet at will and piece together. We believe that those who are the early adapters and have learned some lessons, and you'll see a little bit about that in the next slide, will need to teach those lessons to the next group of folks, that the lessons will need to be relearned by the converts, that making this digital transformation, you know, will happen one publisher at a time, and they're all going to have to learn from one another. But bottom line, there is no doubt that moving products from print to digital is going to be the number one business strategy for impacting your bottom line. Again, some facts that substantiate that. We did a survey of our membership to see, you know, between 2008 and 2009, how many were pursuing additional delivery platforms. And, you know, it's no surprise that the numbers showed that many of them were moving away from investing in print product development to digital products, and that actually has shown up in the products that we have seen this year to be evaluated. And an interesting slide is this, you know, those who describe themselves as high digital companies have reported more positive outcome both in sales results, anticipated growth, and general business optimism than those who describe themselves as medium or low in terms of their investment in digital. So that just leaves a few recommendations, and this is what we have to offer from the lessons we've learned, that everybody needs to position themselves for a quick response. The change can take place very quickly, and that this involves honing your editorial and acquisition and production processes so that you can be prepared to deliver, 24/7 on any platform. Another important thing is to hire for the digital future, hire people who are digital natives and who have the instinct and the wherewithal to make you think like one, that you're operating in a global arena, that you are, you need to be platform agnostic, keep all of your options open, and finally, partner with the enemy. Keep your eyes open in terms of what kind of developers or suppliers or vendors could potentially be a partner and advance your development quicker. So I've hit my moment.
Charlene, that was great. Thanks for your insight. We've got some questions coming in, and we'll get back to you on those at the end of the webinar. Now what I'd like to do is I'd like to turn it over to somebody who truly is a publisher in this market space of complexity, and that's Michael Ross, Senior Vice President, Encyclopedia Britannica. Michael, take it away.
Good afternoon, everybody. Thank you for inviting me to do this, and that was a great introduction from Charlene. A little bit about what we're doing, and that might surprise people, especially given the fact that we are an extremely old company. We've been around since 1768, but these days I like to talk about us as a 243-year-old startup. We still stick to some of the things that we hold true, like our authority and our trust, but we're doing it in far different ways than we ever were before. We're still the oldest continuously revised publication in the English language, but today continuously revised means daily, not weekly or monthly or yearly. We're still home to the soundest scholarship and finest writers and thinkers. We still have Nobel Prize winners and Pulitzer Prize winners writing for us, as well as experts in all fields. Bill Clinton is one of our authors, Desmond Tutu is one of our authors, Condoleezza Rice, and the list goes on. So some of the things that, still distinguishes us has nothing to do with some of the things that we're going to be talking about later, which is platform and content delivery. We do print sets. We have online databases. E-books are replacing print sets. E-learning solutions for all age groups and all levels of readers. Today, 95% of our revenue is coming from digital publishing. Print is being obsolesced on a daily basis, and from our point of view, I think it's unlikely that we're going to be printing books except on print-on-demand in the next 3 or 4 years. And we're far beyond reference. Today, as you'll see in some slides later, reference alone is not a sustainable category anymore because so much is happening in the classroom itself. Again, thanks to the breaking down of digital walls. So we're now publishing mostly to curriculum products for pre-K, K-8, 9-12, and colleges and universities. That's the other thing that you're really able to do better in a digital environment than you were before, which is to really be specific about who your audience is. Our headquarters and all of our development is based in Chicago. I add this because so much is talked about outsourcing and how much people are doing in India and other places, and we think in the educational environment it's extremely important to have content and technology in your core under your control. It doesn't mean that we don't do outsourcing. It just means that most of what we do is developed right here in Chicago. And, again, something that we really are proud of, I know that people recognize Britannica name, but in any environment it's very important that we remain a trusted source and that we're accountable. And that's the only way we're going to be able to distinguish ourselves from free content. In terms of trends in the marketplace, I think Charlene hit on many of them. What I wanted to focus on a little bit is are some of the economic drivers behind the trend. And those drivers are coming really from the federal government. I mean, we know how hard it is for people to get funding, and we know what's going on in terms of teachers and librarians and the downsizing. So one of the big trends out there is what the federal government is doing to support the states and support the funding buckets. They've identified, the feds have identified innovation and accountability. We've known about accountability for a long time from No Child Left Behind. That's about testing. But the Race to the Top money, which many states are getting now, and I'll show that slide in a second, is not only about accountability, but it's also about innovation and creativity, and something that's very important is productivity. And that has a lot to do with how you discipline these digital natives in an online world. The Common Core Standards, of course, is an attempt to help unify the teaching and what is being taught and what is being learned. Charter schools are also on the ascent because of their ability to get outside of state issues and try to be more innovative and accountable. Everything is going to be technology-based assessment and as well as evidence-based and data-driven practices. College and career readiness, again, is something that the feds have identified as something that's incredibly important. We've done a very bad job, I think, in terms of our public schools in getting kids ready for college. I mean, really ready. Too many kids are going unprepared in both in numeracy and literacy skills. There's going to be an increasing focus on high schools from the feds and college completion even working with the junior colleges to get kids ready better and not just get 30% dropout rate from colleges. We hear a lot about 21st century skills, but specifically what we mean by that is digital literacy. That means the ability to recognize issues both from a visual and also all different ways of getting information. Inventive thinking is a big part of 21st century skills, interactive communication that's both social and personal, and finally, which goes back to the innovation part, quality and state-of-the-art results. We want our kids really to be able to produce exceptional results. The Race to the Top money is, again, it's one of those drivers. I mean, without the money, you're not going to be able to do these things. I must tell you, the money is substantial. The first round winners are up there. You can see $100 million to a tiny state like Delaware, $500 million to Tennessee, and the list goes on. I think there's almost $4 billion there in Race to the Top money for those 14 or so states. That is a very substantial amount of money going into education. Not all of it, of course, is technology-based. Much of it is infrastructure. Some of it is teacher salaries. But there's a lot of money out there to do what we need to do. In terms of, again, the Digital Council PEN policy recommendations and how they want this money spent, they're focusing on, the following. They want to make all students eligible to be digital learners. They want to give all students access to high-quality online courses and content. That doesn't mean that those dominate their learning environment. It means that they have access to them. They want to allow students to customize their learning via online content. That obviously makes a lot of sense. Allow students to advance at their own pace. This whole idea of formative assessment and to expect kids, 30 kids in a classroom to all be at the same level is absolutely ridiculous. And technology helps us to address kids at different levels. To ensure that all online content is high quality, and that probably doesn't mean free. It may be free. Free doesn't mean it's not high quality. But it may not all be free if one of the criterion is to be of high quality. And to ensure that instruction and teachers are high quality, to allow multiple providers of content, that means that one or two or three publishers are not going to dominate, which was the case, as you all know, in a textbook environment. to measure content instruction by student learning, which means outputs and outcomes, create a funding and pay incentives for performance, and to build infrastructure to support digital learning. I think these are all aligned, in my mind, with proper goals for our kids and also good direction for publishers and content developers. Some of the market impact of digital technologies. Technology improves outcomes and saves money. There's increasing evidence that this is the case, that schools with a one-to-one student computer ratio outperform non-one-to-one schools. Even though that's an ideal, probably most people won't achieve it. It does produce better results. That the projected average savings for schools who do implement one-to-one computing is about $700 per student per year. That's significant. The lower the student-to-computer ratio, the better the student outcomes. I think that even intuitively, I think we know that this is the case. And that technology-assisted interventions, which is being identified by spending by the government, with the top model predictors of improved high-stakes test scores and affects dropout rate and discipline. And then finally, technology enables a student-centric environment where, it encourages a student-centric environment. Students can work at their own pace. The teachers can be more facilitators, and there can obviously be more individual and group instruction. This is kind of a visualization of something that Charlene mentioned. She used the same source I did, so I'm glad to say that we're consistent in our data, where Charlene mentioned $3 billion are being spent in the supplemental market and $2 billion in the textbook market, and you can see how, by the pie, where that's divided among math, science, reading, and social studies. And how that tiny little round circle there is online encyclopedias, which you can see is why we're not focusing there anymore and why I'm focusing on the core curriculum. But the key point of this slide is that both of these funding sources, the $3 billion and the $2 billion, together it's $5 billion, are all moving toward online solutions. In the past, that they were almost primarily print-based, it's soon going to be almost all digital.
Michael, I have a question for you from one of our participants.
Sure.
And that's, given this market set of dynamics, how do you, as the Encyclopedia Britannica, market your services and capabilities to colleges, universities, K-12 organizations?
Right. Perfect. It's the next slide.
Oh.
It's exactly, you led me right into it. There have been lots of things that we've had to do to change. And to change our business model, in addition to just making everything digital. I mean, we've been on the Internet for 18 years. But we deliver all of our product in terms of solutions to curriculum needs, whether it's science, math, or general information. And all of that is based on a subscription model. And we have found that the subscription model is something that colleges, universities, K-12 are all very comfortable with. The model is based on FTE, which means full-time equivalent. So we take the number of kids in a school and multiply that by a number, and we come up with the cost to the school. It turns out to be a tremendous value for schools where the schools are paying roughly for our content somewhere between 60 cents and $2 per kid per year. I mean, 60 cents, that's less than a can of Coke, and that's what they pay per year for an entire access 24/7 to our content, which is extremely, you know, rich. And I think that model is a sustainable model. What I said afterwards, what I said about the pricing issue is that unless the volume is extremely high, unless your penetration is very high, the pricing is going to be difficult for people to sustain. I mean, I said 60 cents, and that's per kid, and that's only because we have 75 million users. If that number goes down, or if it if there's a kind of dilution in that number, it's very costly to keep these things maintained. But it is a model that schools and libraries, from pre-K right through college, are buying into. And if they see that the content is progressing and it's moving and it's accomplishing what it needs to accomplish, they think it's a great deal. In our model, we stress renewals. We're trying to make them automatic, so there's less time spent on renewing. We have about a 97% renewal rate. So it's kind of like your cable networks. We are moving more aggressively from the library to the classroom, and that's because that's where the learning is going, and that's when those walls are being knocked down anyway. And from our point of view, we're recruiting more local rep coverage so that we can provide the professional development that was described before and make sure that people are getting the most that they can get out of these new learning environments.
Just one other quick question that came through, Michael.
Yeah.
You mentioned that you're creating, classroom content.
Right.
What new content are you creating for actual classroom lessons, both the core type and supplemental?
Yeah, well, we've got 25 right now. Again, I don't want to be too much of a commercial for Britannica, but we have about 25 revenue-generating websites. And those websites go from English language learning products for pre-K to 2, which are full of animations and music and all this delivered online, to a K-6 math program called Smart Math, which does formative assessment, again, which is right in the classroom. We have a product called Science Pathways. And there are dozens of products all about addressing needs. I was talking to Charlene earlier about a new product that we have called ImageQuest, which delivers 2 million rights-cleared images with citation and metadata, citation information, captions, and metadata that really is a solution to what the craziness that goes on in Google. So, I invite you to come to our sites and take a look at what we're doing. And part of the problem with this whole digital environment is to create awareness for your products and to make it clear to people not only what they do but what needs they're serving.
Right. Thanks, Michael.
To go on, this is my last slide, and here are the recommendations that you asked me to provide. I would say, based on our own experience, is that you really need to establish a 5-year digital strategy. I know that 5 years sounds like a long time in the electronic world, but if you don't know where you're going, any road's going to get you there. You may not follow the path that you put down, but you need to have more than just a 1-year strategy, 2-year strategy. It's just not going to work. Technology must be part of your core competency. We have about 45 engineers in our company that are working with our editors and designers and producers. They are every bit a part of the team. They are not something on the side. If technology isn't part of your core, it is absolutely impossible to keep up with the kids. Manage and prepare for obsolescing formats. I think this kind of leads into what Christian is going to be talking about with printers, that some formats are obsolescing. They're evolving. Some will remain for a long time, but you have to manage this portfolio. You can't just do it recklessly or do it like you've done before. Two more bullets. I think you have to hire people who will move your digital strategy forward, and that means move it forward without necessarily breaking a lot of dishes. Some people in technology, they're in it because they want to innovate and they want the bleeding edge. That may not be what you want. At the same time, you need people who really understand what the market drivers are and what technology and content must be required. And finally, and this kind of coincides with what Charlene said, prepare to partner to help development and channels. I mean, you cannot, in this environment, do everything yourself. It's impossible. And innovation lies in many places, so you should be prepared to partner.
Great. Well, thank you very much, Michael. And now we've heard all about this migration into the world of digital. And what we're seeing are, in all of this, printing companies that are doing well that are focused on the educational book publishing market. And so I'm delighted to introduce Christian Schomburger, and he's the VP of Operations at Mercury. He's going to talk about how their business model is changing, but it's also a very profitable and productive one. So, Christian, take it away.
All right. Thanks, Barb. Well, as both Michael and Charlene kind of alluded to, times are changing, and times are changing quickly and drastically. And at times it can be a bleak outlook for printers who aren't going to evolve and adapt to what's going on with technology, with the current economy, and so on and so forth. So I'm going to address a little bit about that and what Mercury is doing in these current times and what our outlook is over the next couple of years. But I'd like to start with a brief history on Mercury Print and where we've come from. So Mercury Print Productions was founded in 1969 and was started by Valerie Mannix in the basement of her home with a $400 printing press. And I like to show the different slides. There are images of the slide because it gives a good understanding of where it did start. And from Ravenway there in a small little ranch in Rochester, New York, up to another house, and then finally to the first commercial install at Magnolia Street and then Adirondack. And moving along here to our current structure, Mercury Print Productions is headquartered in Rochester, New York, sunny Rochester, New York, being a little sarcastic there, as Barb can attest to. But we do have three divisions. We've got our offset division, which was formed in 1969. We've got a book division, which is our newest division, which was formed in 2005. And then a fulfillment division in 1998 it was formed. And those are our three current facilities, and they are all located in Rochester, New York. So I'd like to show this as well to kind of give everybody a mindset of what our company's made up in terms of revenue and what division each share holds. So our offset division, which includes an on-demand print room, which has three digital presses, wide format printing, and offset printing, accounts for about 42% of Mercury's revenue. We've got the book division, which was formed in 2005, the newest, accounts for about 45% of our revenue. And then our fulfillment and distribution is about 3% of our revenue. So for the sake of this presentation, I'm going to focus strictly on the book division and focus in on one of the markets that we serve is the educational publishing market. We serve two of the segments, the L-High, or the K-12, and the higher education for college. With the L-High, a lot of the products that we produce would be teacher editions, products for submission and adoptions at the beginning of the life cycle of a title, sampling for sales reps to actually go out and take student editions, again, at the submission adoption, or end of life of a product, getting into the year 5, year 6, year 7 of a life cycle of a book, workbooks and ancillary products, as well as tests and assessments. And on the higher education side, we focus primarily on custom editions that do target the college market. So the primary services that we offer at the book division include print-on-demand, toner-based products, and inkjet-based products as well. With our print-on-demand product, this is one of our newer products. We have custom-built a workflow system, which we call eMercs, which is designed to automate and streamline the order entry and production processes. And we see a huge interest with the publishers here as the quantities begin to get smaller and smaller. And Michael kind of alluded to with how within 3 to 5 years, the only printing he sees doing is in a print-on-demand platform. We also have toner-based equipment. We have HP equipment, Xerox equipment, and Kodak equipment, 17 different toner-based devices. They're all four-color. And we offer the current products on that, and we believe we're going to continue to offer them until they're really no longer a viable solution for our customers. And there's a little bit of uncertainty there about what the future holds for toner-based equipment, especially with the evolution of inkjet and which is the next topic there, inkjet and where it's coming. So with inkjet, the introduction of high-speed inkjet technology, it's becoming quicker and more cost-efficient than ever to produce short-run, which seems to really be an ever-evolving term, a short-run, the digitally printed educational materials. And we see educational publishers continuing to want to reduce their inventories to increase customization, increase, obviously, their cost savings. And it's becoming more and more important as technology is changing. And we believe that new technologies such as high-speed inkjet presses are playing and will play a transformational role on the industry. So there's a lot of market dynamics which are really influencing educational publishers, and that has a direct impact on Mercury or printers in general. And I wanted to focus on two of them with this presentation, one being the economy. We've heard it from Charlene. We've heard it from Michael. The reality is state funding or federal funding for education materials or printed products has decreased. Into technology, the introduction of e-books, iPads, smart boards, really into the educational book publishing market. It was interesting, as I was preparing this presentation, I had seen an article on Fox News, and it's how the Auburn Main School Department had voted to provide all 284 kindergarten children and their teachers in the district with new iPad 2 tablets. And whether you agree with that mindset or not, it really is a reality of what's happening and what our children are growing up with and how the technology is being incorporated at a younger and younger age.
You know, Christian, I got a question that I think is kind of interesting as you look at those two dynamics.
Yep.
And you, I know, are growing in terms of revenue and profit. And one of the questions that came in was, so if I'm a printer, should I just reinvent myself into an e-digital service provider? And I'd like your reaction on that one.
Well, you know, I would say that you want to begin to reinvent yourself and adapt to the new technology and really view printing and the mindset that we're taking at Mercury, that printing's just going to be one form of our output, whether it's an EPUB format, whether it's some other type of content. Printing is just going to be one of the outputs that we offer to a publisher. So it's really changing our mindset from being just a printer to being more of a solution provider and adapting and utilizing technology and how we can continue to offer viable solutions to the publishers.
Great. Thanks, Christian.
You're welcome. So with these two market dynamics, the economy and technology, it really has, as Barb kind of alluded to, fueled growth at Mercury. And I'm going to explain why. When we look at the economy, it's really the publishers need to buy smarter and reduce their costs. And it seems like publishers are focusing heavily on inventory obsolescence. We're hearing it from all of our customers. This is really driving publishers to buy more frequently and in smaller quantities. As one of the publishers had told me so eloquently, if they need 19, they're going to order 19. They're not going to order 100 to have 81 sitting in it. Order what you need when you need it. Also, publishers are looking at TCO, a total cost of ownership, rather than just the unit cost. Digital printing has traditionally had a higher unit cost, and that turns people off to digital printing at first. But publishers are now beginning to consider the cost of inventory obsolescence and warehousing throughout the life cycle of a title. So in the end, when you look at that TCO, digital printing is delivering cost savings. And third, publishers do like the speed of digital printing. Digital printing has enabled the publishers to adjust their buying patterns, which enables them more time to accurately forecast and to order the 19 that they need. When you're looking at the higher education and the custom side, if a professor is submitting a book and they may need it in 2 weeks, they may need it in 1 week, and digital printing gives them the ability to have that. And then also, if you're looking at the Ohio market and talking about submissions or adoption, it enables the publishers to hold off in ordering and getting in the latest content and that's needed or required by the states into those products that are going to go in front of the committee that's going to vote on the adoption. So with new technologies, and the market dynamic, it has fueled growth as well. And because publishers are enabling developing their content for e-books and iPads and et cetera, really the adaptation of this new technology is continuing to grow, and it's going to grow, and that's just the reality. E-books and the iPad will continue to decrease the demand for printed books. We've heard it from Michael. We've heard it from Charlene. It's out there, and it's happening. But we look at it as the decrease in the overvolume is really increasing the amount of titles that we be produced on digital production presses, whether it's in a print-on-demand format or whether or not it's just short run. It's reducing the need for the longer run, longer titles. So how is Mercury adapting? We are focusing on new technologies. We're continuing to invest in new digital printing technologies that are really transforming the traditional mindsets of digital printing. Good example is inkjet technology. It's enabling quicker speeds, cheaper costs, increased automation, and it really does give enormous volume capability. And we're also focusing on workflow, really the print-on-demand mindset and automation. Publishers need the flexibility to offer really both an electronic format of a product as well as a printed product, whether it's for special needs or whatever it may be. So they need the ability to print what they need when they need it in an automated fashion. They don't want to have their buyers doing POs for one quantity, two quantity. It's not efficient. It's not cost-effective. It really needs to be in a true automated print-on-demand manner. So I want to finish up with what my recommendations would be to book publishers. One, it would be embrace new technologies and partner with printers who have. Inkjet printing is really a transformational technology that's evolving very quickly. Speed, cost, and quality are constantly transforming, making digital printing more and more attractive to publishers. And as quantities continue to reduce, as technology is becoming more and more prevalent in the schools, it's a viable option for what still needs to be printed. And I would also say challenge traditional thinking and norms. The TCO versus the unit cost. Don't be scared of the unit cost. Look at the total cost of ownership. Publishers should be solving the problem at the lowest total cost, not the lowest unit cost. And that's a change of mindset for a lot of publishers out there, but it's one that they need to drill down and understand. Also, inventory obsolescence. Publishers should assume that the forecast is going down really before betting that it's going to go up. It seems to be the trend out there. And then also look to automate the order transmission. Seek a printer that can accept electronic delivery of formats like XBits and CXML, and for a printer that's going to be able to take that ticket and to automate the production throughout their shop and offer a quick turnaround at a unit cost. It doesn't matter if you're printing at 1, 2, 3 quantity or 500 or 600 quantity.
That's great. Now, let me go through. I've got a couple questions for you, and then I'm going to open it and see if you've got other questions, key them in. I've got a number of them. But a couple for you, Christian, and then I've got several that have come in for both Charlene and Michael. And I know the answer to this, but I'm going to ask the quick question of you, which is how much work are you doing in the inkjet side right now?
Right now, we're not doing any. We just took delivery on our press a couple weeks ago, and we are just gearing up. But we have a significant, we're anticipating a lot of volume based on some commitments that we have that's going to transition over to inkjet because really everybody wants that lower cost per page.
Okay, and I'm going to ask two more quick questions, and I've got a couple for Michael and Charlene.
Okay.
One of them, and I'm going to let you explain it, is what are XBits and CXML?
XBits and CXML is pretty much a programming language, and XBits was developed as a standard template, in essence, for the automatic transmission of data and of ticketing information. In essence, XBits is a format of XML and CXML, which is just a programming language that is common that within the programming world that you can go ahead and receive in. And it's also what JDF, which a lot of printers will know what that terminology is built off of. It's a format of XML, and it's something that we can take in that our equipment and printers and inkjet printers and finishing equipment, if it's new and automated, will be able to understand and automatically take and read that information.
Great. Now, let me turn this one over to the next question I've got for Michael. You mentioned that you're doing a lot of work in migrating from what I'll categorize as best-in-class reference materials, which I remember growing up with, to doing a lot more classroom activity. Are there other publishers that are moving in a comparable direction, Michael?
Well, I think yes. The answer is yes. I mean, especially if you have traditionally been a reference publisher, it's just really a question of, you know, where the funding is going and what's happening to libraries. Libraries, more and more are not buying print. They're not investing in print products. They are investing in e-books. So you're seeing a replacement of funding for print to e-books, which, of course, are not similar to online databases, but they are a digital product. And once you start migrating these things to the digital world, it's a lot easier to combine reference content with learning content, with instructional content, with multimedia. So the migration is a logical one and a normal one. In fact, what's happened is it isn't that so much publishers are doing it, it's that users are demanding it. They're demanding more and more out of their digital products. So, and we find it almost impossible, actually, to economically keep up with the demands that users are making. So there is that issue as well. But the answer is yes, you're seeing more and more of it. In every conference you go to, every show you go to, you see publishers going into this territory.
And this one, Charlene, is for you. Well, we heard Michael talk about the fact that they're not going to be producing physical books for more than another 3 years. What about the rest of the textbook publishing marketplace? How long do you expect them to produce physical textbooks parallel to developing e-formats?
Can you hear me?
Yep, I sure can.
Good. I wanted to make sure I was unmuted. You know, the answer to that question is, it will take as long as it takes for the marketplace to demand the shift. I mean, I think one of the things that people sometimes forget is that, you know, publishers are not driving the market. The market is driving what the publishers produce. So clearly, you know, there are already states in which, you know, the idea of accepting instructional content only in digital format is already in place. You know, how long it will take for every state to catch up and have the technological capability to deliver to every student in, you know, digital format is an open question. But I can say that it's, you know, it's happening, it's accelerating very rapidly, and I put that question back, you know, on the market. The publishers aren't going to drive the market. The market will drive the publishers.
Okay. And this one's for Christian. Christian, what do you think the biggest challenge for publishers is to adopt to this new on-demand type model? How rapidly do you see that happening, and what are your selling challenges with publishers?
You know, the biggest challenges would be, I would just say, from an IT resource standpoint and dealing with making sure that they have the systems in place to output and to transmit the whether it's an XBITS format or XML over to the printers, you know, and we're seeing publishers really adopt and adapt to this technology and start to use it. What was the other part of that question, Mark?
What are your biggest selling challenges with those publishers?
Well, it's a different mindset, you know, and it's something that's unknown for the publishers that if they haven't ever embraced the new technology that's coming. So it's a change in mentality, and there seems to be a lot of hesitation on having the lights out or the hands-off approach on whether or not the orders are going to transmit through, whether or not the product's going to get produced when it needs to get produced, and that it's going to make its way to the end user. So just because it's a different way and a completely different mentality, there just seems to be a little hesitation with wanting to move that direction and with a change.
Okay. And, Michael, I've got one last question, and then we'll be at the top of the hour for you. And that's, because I know you're doing it, how do publishers monetize their digital content?
That's the most important question you could ask.
That's what I was thinking.
If you don't make money, it's impossible to do great things. I mean, you monetize it by, you know, going where the market is buying your products. E-books are growing very rapidly. We have seen a huge increase in the growth of our e-books. And e-books really are just print books. They're just books that you now convert into an EPUB format, an open EPUB format. And it's very inexpensive to do that. With this, you've already invested everything in the content itself. Go ahead and make an e-book. You can print it, too, if there's a market for it. But e-book is a great way of monetizing digital content. And you can do, each time you do a new copyright, you have a new e-book. The other way to do it is through large database solution-driven e solution, e-learning solutions that I described earlier, where you charge a subscription. And the great thing about a subscription is if you do a good product and you have it put it out there at a good price and it's really helping kids and really helping teachers, people will renew it every single year. It's a much better model than print. Huge. You know, all you have to do is just, you know, keep it up to date. So there's several ways where you can monetize, and I think that the prospects for monetizing digital publishing without waste is tremendous.
Great. Well, we are at the top of the hour, and I'd like to thank all three panelists. I think you've provided tremendous insight both from the association perspective that represents the entire publishing community, a publisher, and then somebody that takes that publication and gets it disseminated, whether it's in print or electronic form, and gives publishers flexibility. Thank you so much for joining us this afternoon. We appreciate your participation. And again, many thanks to Charlene, Michael, and Christian.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.